This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Thanks for joining us. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you on our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to start our show with a country that's been in the news occasionally and not always in a good way. South Sudan is the world's newest country, and it's one fraught with violence, poverty, disease, and poor access to education. Suzanne Jumbo is a peace activist and politician from South Sudan who was instrumental in developing the country's foreign policy and writing its constitution. Jumbo left the ruling party over disagreements with that nation's president. Chief among her concerns was the status of women in the political process. She says she's going to run for president in the country's next election. The Fargo-based nonprofit literacy group South Sudan Reads brought Jumbo to North Dakota to learn how education efforts in the U.S. might help the South Sudanese. And she told Main Street's Ashley Thornburg she knew she wanted to make a difference when, as a child, she saw religious and political leaders killed for promoting peace and diversity.
And I felt very affected by it. I felt that I want to grow up to advocate for voiceless people. No one should be sentenced to death or killed for his or her different opinion. The society must be multi-pluralism and accepting and tolerant to other views and opinions. That's how I grew up to be an activist since then, which led me to working with internally displaced communities in Khartoum at the time because of the war. It was late 1980s, and I really wanted to be part of help alleviating the suffering of our people. And during that time, it was the thickest of the first war, the war that started in 1983. So it was in the late 80s. Then I started helping in voluntary work at the local church where I attended. So we'd go and distribute humanitarian supplies to people, like food and basic clothing, and a little bit of counseling. I decided as well to study law, and I felt that by studying law, I'm actually being empowered in order to help with drafting of constitution that is based on human rights and diversity of the people. I came back immediately after I graduated from law school in England then to come and join, be part of peacemaking in South Sudan. So by 1999, I was picked at a human rights conference, and at the time working for UNICEF, I was picked by the late leader of the SPLM, founder of the SPLM, Sudan People's Liberation Movement, which helped liberate South Sudan. So he picked on me to be part of the negotiating team, the peace negotiating team. So I actually entered into the era of peacemaking. And as a woman, of course, I was a young woman, and as a youth, to represent the views of women and youth who were marginalized. They're still ironically marginalized, a long journey, of course. And yeah, so that led me to be part of the people who signed the peace agreement in 2005 after many years of close to about 40 years of civil war in South Sudan. So finally, peace had been ushered into the country. And the last assignment I had before exiting politics in 2005 was being part of five member commissioners to draft the first constitution of the then regional government of South Sudan, ensuring that women were particularly integral in that. With the 25% affirmative action, women continued to lag behind due to negative traditions and cultures, as well as the conflict itself. Conflict always sidelines people who are not armed, you know, so women obviously are the majority bulk of that group. In a country that has been, or a population that has been undergoing conflict for so many years, it's very hard to bring about the culture of peace, peacefulness, equality, and justice between the people. So immediately we gained our independence in 2011. Unfortunately, things such as corruption, tribalism, segregation between the people, violence, the culture of violence, all these things became more prevalent in the country because, you know, it takes a long time to adapt to normalcy. If you have been living in conflict for so many years, that's what you know. So our decision makers in the country really do not understand what it means to dialogue, to sit down together and talk, and also be regulated by laws, and to respect that citizens also have a right just like anybody else in the country and all that. So increasingly I found myself a fighter from within, a reformist from within, to try and voice my concern within the ruling party, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, SPLM. And I realized that it was a tough journey, that there were so many challenges. decision makers felt like public money was their money, for example, and so it's not for schools, it's not for hospitals, it's not for roads, so no answerability and accountability to the population, and the state organs such as the parliament, which is the legislative body, is not really acting its role as it's supposed to be, which is to oversight the executive, the government, the branch of the government, and the judiciary wasn't quite independent. So many things started jamming, and the government went on an extreme rigid standpoint that we're going to win this war militarily. So I became increasingly a more even sidelined voice, because I'm like, okay, people differed and differed sharply and violently. So is there a way that people could dialogue instead of fighting, instead of military? So unfortunately, President Kiir, him and I started differing very sharply. Ethnic polarization became an issue and came with it violence. So communities became hostile toward one another. So for the first time, war transcended not only between politicians and military rulers, but actually it went down to communities. And to me, that became a very dangerous point. And I felt that all the times as South Sudanese, we were united. We were one people, regardless of our political difference. We did not fight one another as communities. Politicians and military rulers did, but not the people. This was very scary. So 2014, 2015, it just became very impossible to speak with the current President Kiir on prioritization of people-to-people peace, communities-to-communities peace. And, of course, all along I was always concerned about women and children of South Sudan, because they're the majority victim in this whole war. And so we fell apart. I declared my defection completely from the ruling party 2017 January, and a few months later I started a new political party which is based and anchored on peace and democracy, which are the two things really missing in South Sudan.
You mentioned the need to empower women, and you mentioned that the most impacted tend to be the women and the children, and there is something about conflict and war that takes the most marginalized people and continues to marginalize them more. So if you could just sort of paint a picture of what life was like where you were living, specifically for women and children, and perhaps women and children of a little bit less means than you seem to have.
South Sudan has been undergoing conflict from 1955 to 1972, with a small period of lull period of relative peace until 1983. So In the two wars, majority of the population, especially the men and the youth, the male youth, took up arms. They were in the front lines. And women remained behind in communities. Women became heads of household uniquely. So they became actually, this is one of the things that I say, conflict sometimes produces opportunities, ironically, for women in Africa. So while men are in front lines, women take up the leadership within their households and take care of not only the children, but also the elders in the community. Before I joined the Peace Talks as part of SPLM, I went into communities and I saw a lot of women taking charge of things. And it was amazing, which I documented in my first book, to meet with women and see women were running restaurants for the first time in the history of traditional South Sudan. Women were running adult learning schools and things like that. So they had actually taken up the opportunity on themselves to empower themselves and to take care of the communities. But unfortunately, all those gains by 2005, it was like almost in a subtle way women were told, go back to the kitchen. When 2005 came, the leadership took it upon themselves. For example, from members of parliament, majority were appointed, there were men, and ministers at the state level were men. Decision-making such as Ministry of Defense, Foreign Affairs, Finance, and Ministry for Interior, which is in charge of security, is all men. So basically, it was like the men said, we are back from the war, so can you just chill the women? Can you just sit back and do nothing? So where I come from, what I've seen and what I've witnessed is extreme sidelining and disappointment and let down to the women, and of course, by default, the children of South Sudan. And that's the situation continues. The status quo continues like that. And it is very important in order to have success in education, in agriculture, in health, and all of that, women must become an integral part of that, and as what I see, for example, in Rwanda with the leadership, because that's where I see the political will of a leader, of leadership in the country, featuring a very significant and important that President Paul Kagame of Rwanda, for example, earlier on he decided in order to make the country in harmony, at peace, women were his partners, were the partners of the government to ensure that the people became one people instead of tribalism and segregation. So the peace messages reached out fastest to communities through the significant and central role of women. And he also made sure that there were not any women, but women who are also young and progressive. So, you know, that was amazing. So that's the sort of thing I would like to see in South Sudan, for example.
Main Street's Ashley Thornburg in a conversation with South Sudanese politician Suzanne Jumbo, who came to North Dakota to speak at a literacy event for South Sudan Reads. Coming up, Jumbo outlines her plans for improving life in South Sudan.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, another edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour Book Club.
Robinson Crusoe by Daniel Defoe, written when Defoe was 60 years old, published in 1719, one of the most extraordinary novels ever written, and one of the first.
We talk about how Jefferson must have reacted to this book. We know he had it in his library.
It was a classic Enlightenment tale of a man who washes up on a deserted island and with a limited number of tools has to build an economic life and does so with great brilliance until he finds a footprint in the sand.
And David Nicandri joins us for a little bit of a different take on the book.
I asked my friend Nicandri, who's a historian of exploration, what happens when one tribe meets something completely different. Do they fight? Do they cooperate? What kind of tensions are at the center of these encounters?
Join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. Millions of people have fled South Sudan in recent years, and hundreds of thousands have died in ongoing conflicts. Suzanne Jumbo has seen the chaos up close, and it motivated her to speak up and get involved. Our Ashley Thornburg talked with her.
Every time as women or the women's movement, we build on what other women have accomplished around the world. So personally, I studied a lot of how the women liberation movement in generally and generically developed and evolved in countries such as Sweden, Norway. And that to us is something to emulate from. Then you move on to countries such as Eritrea, which also was a country that just had its independence in the early 1990s. It was said that women of Eritrea liberated Eritrea. And when I was doing my first, there was a book that I wrote, Overcoming Gender Conflict and Bias. It took me 3 years studying the cases of Eritrea and South Africa and Uganda, where they were somewhat post-conflict nations. Eritrea, for example, went through an armed revolutionary movement where women had, I'd say, liberated Eritrea. But when it came to forming the government and setting up the country, the women were told in a subtle way, go back to the kitchen. So in the book, I tried to ensure that when we, South Sudanese women, come our turn, we should avoid that pitfall. And that's why we made sure it was part of the constitution. Rwanda later on educated us more, informed us more. The same thing with South Africa, the ANC, the ruling party, African National Congress Party. People like the late Winnie Mandela, hadn't it been for Winnie Mandela, Mandela probably would have been long forgotten in that Robben Island. That's my thinking. I grew up as a little girl in kindergarten, early primary school, where all the kids would, in secondary school or university, they would call upon us, let's go and demonstrate peacefully in protest for the people of South Africa because of the apartheid. And of course, having to study in England, that was at the time more or less the legacy of the late Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady. But people were still talking thinking about Margaret Thatcher. I mean, 10, 20 years down the road, people are always talking about Margaret Thatcher. And I remember how that there were two of them, Margaret Thatcher and one other baroness. They were the only two ladies who were in the House of Lords, and how that was very important, and how they waged their way through those old, rigid men. Because, I mean, the House of Lords is a very tough house to enter into as a woman. So watching documentaries and series on television, I was doing my law degree in England, that influenced me a lot, you know. So you have to be very strong, you have to be very clear-sighted in the way you speak as a woman, and have your facts ready. And that's how Margaret Thatcher conducted herself. So in the end, men didn't look at her as just a woman, as we say in Sudan, Mara Sakit. No, they looked at her as a very tough woman. So as women, unfortunately, we have to work double as much men. And, of course, then Uganda was very important at the time when I was doing the book, because the leadership in Uganda, Museveni, also embodied the vision of women equality with men. So he was actually the first African ruler within the entire continent at that point to visibly, in 1986 until the time now he's been president, to visibly and consciously make affirmative action within the constitution in Uganda, as well as making sure that aggressive political appointment of women into various decision making. So that made a lot of a huge difference.
So you've mentioned a lot of countries and people that certainly would have influenced you in ways to emulate in terms of writing the new constitution for South Sudan. Where did you look for opportunities to set South Sudan apart in writing the new constitution?
I looked at about four elements, and of course consequently looked into those constitutions. One is human rights. So obviously there's none other than the United Nations itself. So making sure that all United Nations conventions were fully adapted within the Constitution of South Sudan 2005 to 2011. So that was very key for us, because there are issues such as women's right as human rights within the various conventions, women in peacemaking within the various conventions, like the Resolution 1321, for example, you know, where women should be part and parcel of post-conflict making, because it's a country that is precarious. It's in between coming from war at that point and into a nationhood. So women must be featured highly within peacemaking as well as later on in decision-making in the country. And as well, of course, you have conventions such as on children's rights, because to me, I'm also very concerned that children in a traditional African society that has been marred by conflict, children tend to be traumatized. And if we want to continue the journey by women who are adults, then it's very important we also ensure that the continuation continues with the children as well. The human rights aspect came from the United Nations, and of course, federalism. In its truest meaning, obviously we're talking about evolution of powers. We did not want to have centralized powers, least of all centralized powers within the name of the president, and of course within the various organs of the state. So if you have a federal system, then you want to make sure that the various states within South Sudan also have their own powers within there. The third element, of course, is inclusivity. No one is above the law. Everybody is equal before the law, so that people feel the sense of belonging, feel the sense of, no, you know, I'm not inferior to another, that kind of thing. So I'm protected by the law of the nation, as it were. Fourth element, which I take very passionately as well, is the environment. South Sudan has been a country that has diverse natural resources. I mean, oil has been been exploited in South Sudan since 1997. And I've had the opportunity through my civil society work to have been able to travel and find out about oil practices in South Sudan. And I saw the impact on the community was horrid. Places where fresh rivers no longer exist anymore because of oil spillage into the rivers. So women were giving birth to children with weird deformities that were never there. I mean, it's abnormal, completely abnormal. And then, of course, our diaspora, South Sudanese, have been living outside the country for decades, and they have been exposed to all sorts of amazing experiences and knowledge And they would have been extremely resourceful to have them back and make attractive packages to come back and work in the country to help develop the nation, because they are from South Sudan, but they have had the opportunities to go outside and live abroad and learn so many things in those other countries. And they would have been able to help us a lot in the making of that nation.
Well, yes, working with Sudanese people within South Sudan, and then the vast diaspora of people who have left by their own means or by force. Mm. And we are in Fargo at a literacy event. So let's talk about how literacy in particular is a key element to talk about when it comes to the South Sudanese government.
Yeah. Literacy is central. In South Sudan, it is estimated 90% illiterate. When we say 90% are illiterate in South Sudan, I'm talking about the majority of that are actually women. So the 10% who are educated, majority of which are actually men. So women probably are 1% of the educated, out of the 10% educated. So that would benefit women primarily when we adopt literacy as a key area. So women can be financed and given bank loans, for example, soft loans. And on the job, they can be trained on how to do accounting, how to account for their money, how to manage the money that they have acquired to run the business, and how to manage the business and all that. So I'm talking about functional literacy as well. You know, so literacy in the conventional manner, but as well functional literacy, because we have to fast track. I mean, the population, 90%, we cannot isolate them. 10% cannot rule everybody.
So how does having a literacy-based group in the United States like South Sudan Reads, how does that work with building literacy rates in South Sudan?
If I were to sit on any funding or any support, whether technical or financial, to an organization such as South Sudan Reads, I would fund it 101%. And I would ask Reads, can you multiply? Can you become 20, 1,000 of you in South Sudan? Because that's the sort of organizations and groups that we really need in the country to help encourage people to understand how does education impact on the person. It impacts on me, for example, in how I can learn about my health. What kind of water should I be drinking? So it can be even an issue of survival in the country. And it can teach people, for example, about HIV AIDS, about malaria. I mean, so many basic things. What kind of food can I eat that is healthy for me? And so forth and so on. So basically, South Sudan Reads and any similar organizations that champions and empowers people educationally is needed like yesterday.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much as well. Thank you. I really enjoyed this.
That was Ashley Thornburg speaking with Suzanne Jambo, a peace activist and politician from South Sudan. Jambo has announced her intention to run for president of that country in 2021. Coming up on Main Street, a Plains Folk essay from Tom Ezern. Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom and our What's Happening calendar. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Police in Grand Forks say they have responded to two opioid overdoses in as many days. And in both cases, some quick thinking has helped save the individuals' lives.
It was just two individuals at residences and ingested substance, ended up overdosing. Other people present were able to call 911. First responders got there. CPR was performed on both. Both were also given doses of naloxone or Narcan, which fortunately revived them.
Police Lieutenant Brett Johnson says Grand Forks Public Health will be distributing naloxone free of charge this week and Monday of next week. He says it is also available over the counter at a downtown Grand Forks pharmacy. Johnson says while he is encouraged by the awareness and community support, he's also a bit disheartened.
Well, it's unfortunate that it happens often enough that we are able to so quickly know what to do.
Johnson says the two recent incidents once again show there is no safe way to use illicit drugs like heroin, but there are prevention tips to keep in mind in order to make it as safe as possible. And Governor Burgum says things are going forward in terms of the proposed Theodore Roosevelt Library and Museum planned for Medora. The legislature has set aside $50 million for the project if and when $100 million can be raised privately. Burgum told reporters the private fundraising efforts have begun. He says two chairs have been named, Theodore Roosevelt V and Melanie Walton.
We've had a series of good introductory events, and I would say interest is strong in the early days of this thing. I think people see that there's, again, an opportunity here to invest in something that is significant, that's going to leave a tremendous legacy, and that's going to have an opportunity to be really relevant to the country today.
Burgum says there is no deadline for the fundraising effort. Meanwhile, Federal Interior Secretary David Bernhardt came to North Dakota to tour the Theodore Roosevelt National Park and to discuss the plans for the library. It had been suggested that one location for the library would be on National Park land. Bernhardt says that is a possibility.
I think there are multiple options. There could be something done on the park. There could be a land exchange. There could be something outside. And what we want to do is make sure it's successful for everybody. That's the most important thing to us.
Edward O'Keefe has been named the CEO of the Theodore Roosevelt Library Board. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and a great storyteller. His Plainsfolk essays weave history with a literary style told with his voice. Today's essay has an attention-getting title, A Horrible Sight and a Terrible Death.
In one of our family photo albums is a snapshot of me, age preschool, sitting astride our prize polled Hereford bull. I'm pretty sure his name was Domino. In the mid-1950s, you see, Hereford bulls were docile dwarves and without horns. Previous generations, however, were accustomed to hearing and reading horror tales of mortal or near-mortal gorings by bulls and cows. Such things were everyday hazards that made convenient newspaper copy with shock value. Trigger warning here. Some of the content to follow details incidents of violence. Interestingly enough, there are few reports of such incidents befalling cowboys on the range or in pastures. More commonly, they have to do with farmers or even townspeople, such as the unfortunate Mrs. John Poole of Grand Forks in 1895. Her husband had gone out of town and left her to care for a bull that was chained to a post. Evidently, the bull broke the chain. And when Mrs. Poole attempted to reattach the beast, she was, press reports said, horribly mutilated and literally gored to pieces. The bull commenced bellowing, which attracted the attention of neighbors. The bull was finally killed, says the news report, after 15 Winchester rifle bullets had been fired into his body. Well, the same year, Robert Ewing of Pembina was attacked by a bull he was taking to water. By the time Mrs. Ewing had driven off the attacker by sicking the dogs on him, Mr. Ewing had suffered broken ribs and a horn driven through his leg. He died the next day. "It is a very sad case," said the press report, "as the widow and children are without money or means." A few years before, in 1891, regional readers had learned the sad fate of Albert St. John, who farmed a few miles east of Hope. Some family members flagged down the mailman, Casey Foster, and took him to the barn, where a gory scene awaited. "Mr. St. John was lying a crushed and lifeless mass in the manger," reported the Hope Pioneer, "with his dead bull atop him." Family and friends reasoned the bull had attacked and gored Mr. St. John in the barn, tossed him into the manger, become entangled in his tether rope, and fallen in atop his master. "It was a horrible sight and a terrible death," mourned the reporter, "and his family have the sympathy of the entire community in their terrible affliction." Country newspapers not only detailed such local tragedies, but also reprinted exchange reports of gorings from across the country, to the point where a certain reader numbness may have set in. This could explain why the editor of the Washburn Leader was emboldened to ungentlemanly reportage in 1893, when he wrote that a woman in Milton had suffered a 3-inch deep stomach wound inflicted by a bull, but was not mortally wounded because of her extreme corpulency. News reports, such as a couple from the year 1900, dealt also with violence done against other animals by horned beasts. A new settler named Behan, near Botno, demanded satisfaction when a valuable cow of his was killed by a cow belonging to Charles West. "Charles paid the expenses like a man," reported the Botno Courant. More fortunately, after a bull gored a prized horse belonging to a Manfred farmer, the local vet saved the horse by removing 4 feet of damaged intestine and splicing it back together. It is little wonder that during the times I have been describing, the practice of dehorning cattle, controversial but effective, commenced and caught on. That campaign for public safety is the subject of my next essay.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up, Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the North Dakota Farmers Market and Growers Association, helping North Dakota farmers, ranchers, and gardeners market their products through farmers markets, grocery stores, and restaurants statewide. Learn more at ndfarmersmarkets.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg in our Fargo studio and in our Bismarck studio, Sue Balcom.
It's time for another episode of Main Street Eats with Root Cellar Sue. Sue, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And it is still time to be going out in the garden and getting some good produce out there before it gets too cold, although, of course, we're right on that edge of...
We are on the edge, but, you know, our farmer's market goes until the end of October, and we will have a large variety of produce that probably will be available until the end of October. And nothing is funnier than seeing a bunch of farmers standing outside in their boots and parkas, the Air Force type, watching the people drive up, open their window, like, "What do you got?" I'm like, "Get out of your car and come over here, man. We're freezing. We've been here for hours."
Suffer with us, yeah.
Yeah, suffer with us. But in the meantime, for some reason, I can grow peppers like nobody's business. I love peppers.
I do too.
Oh my gosh. I've got green ones and then green ones that turn red. I've grown chocolate peppers and red peppers. Oh, I said red peppers, like red jalapenos. Like if you leave your jalapenos on long enough, they'll become red. And then they're beautiful and hot. And then there's also a variety of jalapeno that is purple that turns burgundy when they get ripe. And oh my gosh, you guys, the peppers are so beautiful. And the ones that you pick out of your garden are so amazing. But when you have a glut of peppers, you're like, what am I going to do with 3 or 4 bushels of jalapenos and green peppers? So I thought maybe we'd share some ideas about peppers.
Well, I have a great idea. Don't wash your hands and then put your contacts in.
Oh.
Yeah, totally done that.
I've got a joke about guys that I
won't
tell.
Let's not go there because girls can do that too. And it is unpleasant. So you want to – I buy boxes and boxes of those blue nitrile gloves because when you handle your jalapenos, you definitely want to wear gloves. And then maybe kick your husband out of the house because he'll complain about his eyes burning. I'm like, oh, you get used to it after a while. So.
Toughen up.
Well, my mother was from Tennessee, and she made the best cornbread. So give us a cornbread recipe with peppers because that's a great combination.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and one of the things you can do when you make your cornbread in your cast iron skillet is you can chop up some jalapenos. But, you know, the popularity of bacon-wrapped, cheese-stuffed poppers.
Oh,
my gosh.
Everywhere.
Stop there.
Oh, you know, I'll bet you we ate 12 peppers the other day, my husband and I, while we watched a football game, because that's like a whole meal for us because they're so good. But then I found this better recipe. You know how that cheese leaks out of there sometimes? Well, if you have these big, beautiful jalapenos, there's a cornbread stuffed jalapeno recipe that I found that's really quite simple.
So you cut your jalapenos in half, and I leave the caps on so that they kind of create a boat. And then take the seeds out, because there's two schools of thought. Either the seeds make it hotter or the seeds don't make it hotter. And really, personally, I've never noticed a difference. But when you're making poppers, I try to get the seeds taken out of there. And then if you don't have a homemade cornbread recipe like I do, then you need to buy a box of cornmeal mix. And the recipe calls for something that had honey in it. Now, I've never seen that type of cornbread, but I think you could add honey later if you wanted to. And then you need shredded cheddar cheese and a cup of corn, which fresh or canned is fine. And you mix up your cornbread mix and you add the corn and the cup of cheddar cheese. And then you fill your jalapeno halves with that instead of with the cream cheese, and sprinkle cheese over the top, and then bake them for about 15 to 20 minutes till that cornbread is cooked. Oh, doesn't that sound just, I mean, my mouth is watering.
Yeah, I'll take a dozen of those right now.
Oh, so if you're watching football, you're having company over, it would be so easy to do this if you had tons of jalapenos. Make poppers on one side of the oven and the cornbread stuffed jalapenos on the other side, and you're good to go.
Can you pickle them?
Oh, yes. I spent all of last night kind of dealing with some of my jalapenos, so I do couple things. I make green jalapeno jelly that you serve over cream cheese or dunk your potato chips in. And then I make seriously, that's how addicting that stuff is. Like, what can we stick in this jelly quick? and the little bit of salt is really good with the sweet, you know. And then I save my red ones off to the side and I make a red jalapeno jelly out of them so that you can have a Christmas treat, red and green jelly on cream cheese.
You're so cute.
And then you can make pickled jalapenos, and those are naturally fermented, and they are amazing, and they're hotter than Hades usually. And that's a pretty simple, just use a pickling recipe and let them sit on your counter, and if they start blowing the tops off of the jars, they're ready to eat for sure. And then I make something called cowboy candy, ooh, which is really popular, and that is a jalapeno slice that's been preserved in a sugar syrup. And I'll tell you what, a grilled hamburger with American cheese and those sweet and hot jalapenos on the top is an absolute treat.
How do you do that with the jalapeno?
You slice them up, and then there's a recipe for lots of sugar and a little couple spices like garlic and red pepper. Like, I don't know why you'd add that, but, you know, just throw it in
there.
Make
sure it's hot.
Yeah. Yes, and then some turmeric and celery seed, and you kind of simmer the peppers in that juice, and then you take those out and fill the jars, and then you boil that juice down so it's thick and syrupy, and then process them process in a hot water bath. They are really, really good. I could send you guys a jar of that. I have a glut.
I'll take one, sure.
Sure.
All right. Christmas is coming, so we have to think about local gifts, you know? And then I have these sweet snacking peppers, you know, the ones that you can buy at the grocery store. You can grow those. And the beauty of those is they don't have hardly any seed in them whatsoever. So I have these beautiful kind of yellowish sweet peppers that I also make a jelly out of. So for people who are too wussy to try the jalapeno stuff, they can have the sweet pepper jelly. And so then the colors of these peppers, like I can grow chocolate peppers, and then you have kind of a brown jelly, and then the yellow and the red and the green. It's just amazing what you can do with peppers. Besides make salsa, that's
right,
pretty key there, right?
Okay, so I want to do a follow-up question on pickling, though.
Okay.
Especially if you're doing like that quick and easy, that refrigerator pickle style, can you just add some to that batch periodically, or do you have to make fresh every time?
Oh, the heck with the jalapenos. Throw some hard-boiled eggs in that juice. Then you have hot pickled hard-boiled eggs.
Oh, you've worked at a bar, haven't you?
Right?
So, oh, yeah. Is it Jim Lowerman's used to serve them on a bed of pretzels with one of those pepperoncini peppers or
pepperoncini.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh, that is the best thing with beer ever. but no, you can keep adding.
You can just add. Okay.
Yep, you can continue to add as you pick them out of your garden.
Oh,
so
perfect.
If you can't use up all your jalapenos, you can just freeze them whole in a bag. Just throw them in a Ziploc bag, throw them in your freezer, and then you can slice them up, put them in your cornbread in the middle of winter. Or you can process them a little first by cutting the ends off and scooping the seeds out or slicing them up. I usually slice mine up and weigh them out, and then if I want to make another batch of jelly or something, I just pull them out of the freezer and they're good to go. You can do that with green peppers also. Like my new favorite soup in the winter is stuffed pepper soup. And so I slice green peppers, take out the seeds and the core, and lay them on a cookie sheet, freeze them, and then have my husband seal-a-meal them for me in like 1-cup packages and throw those in the freezer. You can also cut the tops off and make the stuffed pepper cups and freeze those. And once they're frozen solid, you can seal-a-meal those. And they'll be just perfectly fine for making the real stuffed peppers in the winter.
Well, speaking of the freezer, what if you wanted to take some ice cream out that had some zing to it?
Oh, my gosh, you guys. I'm going to get my milk from my farmer friend right after I talk to you. And then I'm going to make some jalapeno ice cream this weekend. Mm. I found two recipes. One is dark chocolate jalapeno ice cream, and the other one is an eggless ice cream that's thickened with a little bit of cornstarch, so it might not be totally considered ice cream, but they put green food coloring in, which I probably won't do. But oh my gosh, I love like cinnamon ice cream, so I can't imagine how good a jalapeno ice cream would be. And I knew you would love that, Ashley.
I would totally eat that.
Have you ever tried it? Have you ever found it anywhere?
No, I never have.
It sounds good.
Yeah.
Do you make ice cream at home?
I do.
Okay, because it's easy, easy peasy, because you can get those little personal ice cream freezers and then find yourself some jalapenos and some dark chocolate and some cream. And it's really, really easy to make ice cream.
Well, I love chili chocolate.
Oh, so do I. I always look for that at all the chocolate shops when I'm out and about in the big world. But this one chef, let me see if I can find his name here, Janos Wilder from the 4-star Janos restaurant in Tucson, Arizona, makes this chocolate jalapeno ice cream. And then he makes a special sundae that you put the ice cream in a dish and then you put white chocolate sauce over it and candied pecans. Mm. So grow some peppers, baby.
Jalapeno wonders. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, guys.
We check in with Sue Belcom for Main Street Eats once a week. And coming up, what's happening?
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll talk with Kevin Iverson with the North Dakota Census Office about the big census coming up in 2020, and we'll explore what the Worley Project is all about. That's next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
That's the question we ask every Thursday. Ashley Thornburg and I look at that calendar and say, what can we do for fun and excitement, interest this weekend?
My favorite event of the year, pretty much, is the Fargo-Moorhead Visual Artists Studio Crawl. So this is both a Saturday and Sunday, noon to 6 p.m. And what it is several visual artists have opened up their studios. You can go and see them active in the process of creation, whether it's glass blowing or doing some sculpture. There's painting, there's ceramics, there's been tattoo artists in the past. They have just any number of, well, visual art performances. And again, you can just go and see these artists at work. This is Saturday and Sunday, noon to 6 o'clock. both days. The event itself, it's free, but you have the opportunity to go and support these hardworking artists. Just Google FM Visual Artists Studio Crawl to get a map of where to go.
I go every year. It's a lot of fun. I'm going to talk about Hamlet at Theater B. I get to be in it, and it's a lot of fun. And it's not the four-hour version, so it's accessible. It's 7:30 tonight through Saturday and for the next 2 weeks with Sunday matinees. 2 p.m. on October 13th and 20th. It's $25 for adults and senior citizens, $12 for students, although students can get in for $7 on Thursday performances for, you know, if you show your student ID. So Hamlet at Theater B.
The 2019 Game Changer Ideas Festival is coming up on the 5th in Bismarck at the Belle Mayhus Auditorium. The theme this year is American Dream. So every year they pick a theme and they get some of the top speakers of our time talking about this idea. So American Dream, what are our fears, what are anxieties, what are our hopes, challenges, opportunities? What does American Dream even mean anymore? You can hear a number of speakers talking about this at the Belle Mayhus Auditorium in Bismarck on the 5th. This goes 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and tickets are anywhere from $25 to $55.
The screening of First Daughter and the Black Snake is Saturday in Moorhead at the Moorhead State University Classroot Auditorium. It's a film written and directed by Kerry Pickett, who's been on Main Street and has talked about this particular film as well. It'll be shown Saturday at 3 p.m., and the price is right. It's free.
Chuck Fest this Saturday, the 5th in Fargo at the Red River Zoo. You can come and draw with Chuck. Obviously, weather permitting, it's been very cold and a little bit rainy, and those are not fun times to go out with a bucket of Chuck Fest. So check the weather, but otherwise, head over to the Red River Zoo, grab some chalk. There's going to be music and other fun activities and ability to engage with lots of local artists Saturday from 10 to 2.
The Haunted Fort Spookless Family Night is October 5th in Mandan at Fort Abraham Lincoln State Park. Haunted tours, ghouls, and spooks will be on hand, but not to scare, but to guide the little guests. You can visit the Custer Manor, the Old Circus Freak Show, Post Asylum, and the Guardhouse. So lots to see there. Saturday from 7 to 10. Parents with children are free to attend, ages 7 to 12. Otherwise, it's $12 in advance, $17 at the door.
The Whoever Can Come Band is going to be meeting at the Barnes County Museum in Valley City on Saturday from 1 to 4. This is open to any musician. Just bring your instrument and come along. The Whoever Can Come Band, Saturday 1 to 4 at the Barnes County Museum.
Comedy in the Cellar with Nate Abshire is October 4th. In the Front Street Tap Room in the Cellar there. It's downtown Fargo. Professional stand-up comedy. He started performing in 2009, so he's been at it for 10 years. Nate entertains audience with his sardonic wit, keen writing, and playful stage presence. Again, that's Friday. Doors open at 6:30. The show starts at 7. Pre-sale tickets are $15. Tickets at the door will be $20, and this is a 21-plus show.
My pick of the week is Culture in Motion, the FM Crossroads Powwow. This is the 5th and 6th in Fargo at the Shields Arena. Come and check out these amazing performances and the sacredness that is involved in powwow and this ritual. And there's also a number of great craft and food vendors. A Saturday and Sunday, 11 to 8, just $5 for kids and $10 for adults.
Well, my pick, because it's got a great name, is Oof Today. It's Sunday in Rutland, North Dakota. They have a 5K walk run, a parade, demonstrations, Scandinavian food, classic car show, quilt display, craft sale, and as always, more. There will be a hall dinner at the community center at 11 in the morning on Sunday. It's family-friendly. Take in Oof Today at Rutland, North Dakota. That's what's happening.
Trying to find your holy grail? Stop looking. It's right here. Dakota Stage of Bismarck presents Spamalot. The beloved Monty Python movie has become a musical. This adaptation by Monty Python's own Eric Idle and composer John Dupree adapts the classic Monty Python and the Holy Grail into an irreverent and hilarious take on the legend of King Arthur. Spamalot plays October 3rd through the 5th and 10th through the 12th at 7:30 p.m. and October 6th and 13th at 2 p.m. More information and tickets available at dakotastageltd.com or by phone at 701-258-4998.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 3rd. On this date, in 1912, the Jamestown Weekly Alert announced two more towns would spring up near Jamestown. C.S. Buck filed a plat for the town of Sydney, and Jamestown Junction would be situated between Jamestown and Sydney on the Midland Railway line. As new towns arose across North Dakota, the responsibility for naming them generally fell to the person or organization that established them. Many early settlements were named for the town founder, while other towns were named for important people. Many were named for people associated with the railroads. Originally called Centralia, Fargo was renamed in honor of William Fargo, founder of the Wells Fargo Company, who had merged his company with the Pacific Express Company, which held the contract to build the Transcontinental Railroad. The town of Blount was named for railroad official John E. Blount. Bone Steel has a somewhat ominous sound, but it was named for a railroad worker. There is no beach in Beach, North Dakota. It was named for Captain Warren C. Beach of the 11th U.S. Infantry. Hoople was named for a settler, Alan Hoople. Settlers sometimes name towns for places they left behind. You might think that Lisbon was named for the city in Portugal, and in a way it was. The founder's wife was from Lisbon, New York, a town that was indeed named for the city in Portugal. Dr. Von Morris named Watford City after his hometown of Watford, Ontario. Originally called Campbell, Kintyre was named for a peninsula in Scotland. Some towns got their names from geographical features. Center is not the center of North Dakota, but it is considered the center of Oliver County, which, by the way, is named for politician Harry S. Oliver, who just happened to be from Lisbon. Zapp was most likely named because of a coal mine. A railroad official in charge of naming towns knew of a mining town in Scotland named Zapp. And the town of Concrete? Named for a concrete plant. Some place names have connections to Native Americans. Wahpeton was derived from the name of the local band of Dakota Indians. Killdeer was named because Native Americans used the area to hunt deer. Many of the old towns have faded away, but a good many are still on the map. The place names of North Dakota help tell the story of the early settlers and what they thought was important. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
In the 1980s, double agents spying on the Soviet Union began to disappear.
They put their lives in our hands, and we failed them.
Now, computers are being used to discover insider threats. But are their conclusions reliable?
They don't just predict the future, they cause the future.
I'm Dina Temple-Raston. Join me for our next special about the technologies that watch us. I'll be seeing you from NPR News.
I'll be seeing you. This week's Prairie Public Presents coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
A Massachusetts man spent 27 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit. He sued the police officers, who he claims violated his civil rights.
And then the judge asked him what was the award. They said $27,127,000. And that was it. Everybody started crying and all that kind of stuff.
But does all that money matter to him? Plus, the latest on the House impeachment inquiry on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, we'll have our fall movies preview show. Movie buffs Matt O'Lean, Greg Carlson, and Brittany Goodman will share their opinions about the likely hits and misses on the big screen this fall. And later in our show, News Director Dave Thompson will join us for our regular Friday discussion about the big stories and recent headlines. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.